morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 29, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's military junta announces a transitional charter.
The charter is about how the transitional period is going to be organized, what are the bodies to put in place, and the criteria as to who may occupy any position.
We'll have analysis of this week's announcement about transition in Mali. An independent commission has released findings on allegations of sexual abuse in DRC's North Kivu and Ituri provinces. 5,000 cholera cases in 6 of Niger's 8 regions in the last 6 months. And Ugandan police rearrested 2 opposition lawmakers on charges of treason.
I think there is a problem. It is either fooling the nation or it is that they do not want to speak the truth. It's now looking more like, you know, persecuting the political opponent.
And female genital mutilation on the rise in Kenya during the pandemic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Guinean opposition politician says military junta leader Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya continues to impress Guineans with his decisions. Fayami Limono, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party, says Doumbouya on Tuesday visited the burial site of the nearly 200 Guineans who were killed during 10 years of President Alpha Condé's rule. Also on Monday this week, Colonel Doumbouya announced what he called the transitional charter. The announcement came at the end of the first round of consultations between the military and Guinean politicians, civil society, and elders. But Doumbouya did not say how long the transition would last. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has mandated a 6-month transition. Milimuno says the ECOWAS demand is unrealistic.
The charter is about how the transitional period is going to be organized, what are the bodies to put in place, and the criteria as to who may occupy any position in those bodies. Also, it was stated clearly that whoever participates in those transitional bodies won't be candidate for the local election, the legislative election, and also the presidential election. And they have defined it, the mission of anybody participating in that transitional period government. The legislative body for that transitional period will be composed of people from all the constituencies of Guinea. The political party will be represented by 15 people, and the civil society, all those constituencies will be represented.
As you know, ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, has given the junta 6 months within which to have elections. Did the junta address the issue of a transition and how long that should last?
No, they haven't. What they said in the charter is that there will be, you know, the rounds of consultation for all the constituencies to come up with a consensus on how many months, how many years the transitional period will last. The 6 months set by the ECOWAS, everybody knows that it is completely ridiculous to think that in 6 months, with the crisis the country is facing, we can organize elections and those elections are going to be fair and free. No, it will be a sabotage that we follow that guideline given by ECOWAS. We have to take time and make sure this transitional period is successful.
We understand that the junta leader, Doumbouya, has visited or paid tribute to those who were killed during the pro-democracy movement.
We have seen the president of the junta acting in the right way. 3 actions were taken that many Guinean people are appreciating. First, he went to pray on the grave of the first president, the second president, and now he went to the cemetery where all those people during the last 10 years. Remember, here in Conakry, it is over 200 young people, some of them in the 20s, some were still teenagers. So that to give a message that never and ever again a Guinean will be treated that way.
Fayyami Limuno is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. Mali's transitional prime minister announced that the election schedule for February next year may be delayed by a month. Prime Minister Magai says it is important to hold elections that will not be controversial. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has given the military-led transitional government a February 27, 2022 timetable to return Mali to democracy. Mohamed Ibn Chambas is the former special representative of the UN Secretary General and former head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. He says while the ECOWAS demand is understandable, it is also crucial for both sides to continue to dialogue because in the end, the aim is to have credible elections in Mali.
As you know, the ECOWAS has set a timeline by which the transition should end. It was an initial period of 18 months. What is evident is that because of the coup that happened within the coup, some delays have occurred regarding the schedule of activities leading to elections. So it is crucially important that consultations are held between the ECOWAS and the Malian transitional authorities to ensure that the scheduled elections at the end of the transition are not unduly delayed. It is a fact that the elections to be conducted need to be done in a manner that will ensure credible, inclusive, and peaceful elections. These need to be well prepared, and every effort should be made to avoid any circumstances which may result in flawed elections. Because after all, the coup d'etat that ushered in this transitional process was as a result of flawed elections. The position of ECOWAS is entirely understandable that the military are not seen to try to benefit by prolonging a transitional process. That is why ECOWAS often comes up with timelines for the duration of the transitions. At the same time, at the end of the transition, elections that happen must be seen to have been credible and transparent. And for this to occur, there needs to be consultations and discussions with ECOWAS and the wider international community, the African Union, to see what support can be mobilized for the transitional authorities to deliver peaceful and credible, inclusive elections.
Mohamed Ibn Chambas is the former special representative of the UN Secretary General and the head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. You are speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. According to Doctors Without Borders, a more than a month-long cholera pandemic in Niger has led to nearly 5,000 cases of the disease in six of the country's eight regions. The group's head of mission in the country, Halidou Alira, tells Ricky Stryak the outbreak is nearing its end, hopefully, but continued surveillance is needed.
The health services in the affected area are overwhelmed and were not prepared at all to face this kind of situation. Meanwhile, the outbreak is at a comprehensively controlled level. In some regions like Zinde, Niamey, and Dosso, only sporadic cases continue to be recorded. The region of Maradi, Tawa, and Tillaberi continue to large number of cases and deserve full attention. The trend is decreasing. The reason for the decrease of the trend for us was the fast and strong mobilization of the Niger government and its partners, including MSF. I want to mention that the rains are coming to the end, and this is a good news to win the fight against cholera.
Given this outbreak, what are the needs for increased epidemiological surveillance, and would they be used beyond this outbreak?
We can resume the needs in terms of treatment centers, medical items, oral and rehydration points, logistic and medical supplies, items for water treatment like aquatab, health promotion and sanitation, contact tracing to limit the contamination, dead body management, and vaccination to prevent the spread of the epidemic.
What has MSF's response been to the outbreak? And, you know, what are the continued needs that MSF will be responding to?
MSF is supporting the Ministry of Health in terms of management of clinical cases, health promotion, sanitation, capacity building, plus human resource support. We are also setting up treatment centers. We are implementing ORS points, and we are doing medical donation. MSF cannot continue scaling up because our capacity are limited. But we will continue speaking out to get the donors mobilized to release funds for other actors to support the response in Niger.
That was Halidou Alira, head of mission in Niger for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Niamey. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 29. Police in Uganda have rearrested two opposition lawmakers on charges of treason just minutes after they were released on bail in a pending trial facing charges of murder. The National Unity Party lawmakers denied the charges, which they say are politically motivated. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Police spokesperson Fred Enanga in a statement said authorities were holding legislator Sajiri Nyamhammad on fresh charges earlier Monday upon his release. Security personnel traveling at high speed pursued the vehicle that had picked up Sajiri Nyam from a prison in the Wakiso district. When it pulled over, they forcefully put him into their vehicle. Enanga said they were holding Sajirinya at the Special Investigations Division for further processing.
We want to inform the public that Honorable Sajirinya Muhammad has also been rearrested on fresh charges of treason and incitement to violence by the Joint Security Task Team of Investigators.
The other lawmaker, Alan Sewanyana, was rearrested outside the prison gate minutes after his release on Friday evening. The two legislators, both members of the National Unity Platform Party, were arrested earlier this month. They were accused of being involved in a recent spate of murders in Masaka District in central Uganda that left close to 30 people dead. Many of the dead were killed with machetes. The state charged the lawmakers with three counts of murder and attempted murder. In their most recent court appearance, prosecutors told the judge they were still investigating the lawmakers and amended the charge to terrorism, aiding and abetting terrorism. Shamim Malende, the lawyer for both legislators and from whose vehicle Sajirinya was forcefully taken, says authorities keep changing the charges against the men with no valid evidence.
When they speak of inciting violence in Uganda, when they speak of treason, when they speak of terrorism, unlawful assembly, those are political cases in Uganda. So I think that there is a problem. It is either fooling the nation or it is that they do not want to speak the truth. It's now looking more like, you know, persecuting the political opponents, people who belong to the National Unity Platform or against the government, bad policies.
Joel Senyonyi, the National Unity Platform spokesperson, says the arrest of the legislators is President Yoweri Museveni's way of fulfilling his word when he said he would destroy the party led by musician turned politician Bobi Wine.
You know, these guys are bushmen. They were in the bush as rebels, and that's why they're behaving like bushmen. Disregarding court orders, you know, court releases somebody on bail, and you say, no, we shall rearrest them as they get out of jail. And that's what Mr. Museveni is doing.
The legislators' rearrest comes just days after the president clashed with Chief Justice Alphonse Owinyi-Dolo over granting bail to capital offense suspects. While the Chief Justice argued that bail was a constitutional right, Museveni argued that if anyone is arrested for murder, giving that person bail is a provocation and abominable. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The Independent Commission on the Review of the Allegations of Sexual Abuse in North Kivu and Ituri provinces in the Democratic Republic of Congo has released its findings. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization appointed a five-member independent commission in October 2020 to investigate allegations of sexual abuse by its staff in Congo's Ituri and North and South Kivu provinces. Senior WHO officials call the results released Tuesday horrifying and heartbreaking. The commission found that more than 80 alleged cases of sexual abuse occurred during the outbreak between August 2018 and June 2020. Most of the victims were uneducated women ages 13 to 43. Commission member Malik Koulibaly says most of the women who testified said they had been forced to exchange sex for the promise of a job. He says some of the sexual exploitation and abuse was organized through a network operating through the local branch that recruited people to work on the Ebola response. He speaks through an interpreter.
Most victims did not get the jobs that they were promised in spite of the fact that they agreed to sexual relations. Some women declared that they continued to be sexually harassed by men, and they were obliged to have sexual relations to be able to keep their job or even to be paid.
Women who were interviewed said none of the perpetrators had used birth control, and some who became pregnant said the men who had abused them forced them to have abortions. The investigation found 21 of the 83 alleged perpetrators were WHO staff, some Congolese, some from abroad. The other alleged perpetrators were contractors such as drivers and security personnel. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus describes the document as harrowing reading.
The conduct it describes is a sickening betrayal of the people we serve. It's my top priority to ensure that the perpetrators are not excused but are held to account. And I will take personal responsibility for making whatever changes we need to make to prevent this happening in future.
Tedros says four WHO staff so far have been fired and two have been put on administrative leave. He says the alleged perpetrators of rape will be referred to national authorities in Congo for investigation. The WHO chief says that all victims of sexual exploitation and abuse will have access to the services they need, including medical and psychosocial support, and that assistance for their children's education will also be provided. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Female circumcision, known as female genital mutilation or FGM because of its lasting damage, is illegal in Kenya but still forced on young girls by some communities. The COVID pandemic has seen a rise in the practice after schools were closed, but one FGM survivor is working to combat the practice in Kenya's Somali community. Brenda Molinya reports from Garissa, Kenya.
23-year-old Yasmin Mohammed volunteers with Silver Lining Kenya, an organization that champions the rights of young girls and women in Kenya's Garissa County. She is focused on eradicating the illegal and harmful practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM.
As someone who has gone through the act, I know how harmful this is.
She and other activists have joined the government's drive to end cases of female genital mutilation. The number of FGM cases jumped after the coronavirus pandemic forced schools to close, particularly in Somali communities in Garissa.
During COVID, it was a moment of staying together. So that is when parents will realize, oh, these children are growing. So for the ones who are young, there is need for them to go through the cut. For the ones who are going through puberty is when you see, oh, this one is supposed to be married.
The practice of FGM remains illegal in Kenya, with the government pledging to eradicate it by the end of 2022, 8 years ahead of the global deadline of 2030. Maka Kasim, a community leader involved in rescuing girls from the practice, says it still thrives in places like Garissa because of strong cultural and religious beliefs.
The Somali culturals, they believe if a girl doesn't go through the cut, she is like someone who is not clean. She is an unclean person. They also believe that if the girl doesn't go through the cut, she is not also clean to do the prayers.
The Kenyan government's anti-FGM board is leading the campaign against the harmful practice. The board's CEO, Bernadette Loloju, says keeping schools open is critical to combating the problem, but there are other challenges too.
The only big challenge we have is that girls are getting cut at a younger age when they don't understand what has happened to them. So the communities are really coming up with other new ways of evading the law.
Still, Kenya officials say there are hopeful efforts by the government and advocates for the girls will keep the country on track to bring the practice to an end. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Garissa, Kenya.
Burkina Faso's war against Islamist militants has seen security forces criticized for human rights abuses. Now, the battle to win hearts and minds has moved to a new stage, with soldiers using their singing talents to promote the armed forces. Claire Mandugo reports from Ouagadougou.
Police Sergeant Yukuba Sarabia, known by his stage name General Yak, is one of 15 Burkina-based soldiers who sing about battlefield life, loss and fighting the enemy. In a cramped recording booth in Ouagadougou, Sarabia sings into a microphone about heading to war and leaving family and friends behind. Singing soldiers like Sarabia hope their music videos will win public support in the war against Islamist militants and put the military in a better light. He says the song is dedicated to our soldiers, our defence and security forces who are on the front lines, and even those who have lost their lives. He says we have dedicated this song to our soldiers to make them understand that they are our heroes, they are valiant men of the nation, and for their families to be encouraged because families have lost their brothers and men on the front line. Burkina-based director Sanmi Traoré was motivated to make music videos with security forces because his brother is a policeman. He also wants to encourage greater confidence in the military. He says the first priority is to show the force of the soldiers on the terrain in this battle, but it's also to assure the population so they understand that they can count on the people on the battlefield who are there to defend the national cause. But critics say security forces should focus less on promoting fighting and more on respecting civilians' rights. The Collective Against Impunity and Stigmatization of Communities, CISC, documents abuses committed by the armed forces, like the alleged killing of 180 civilians around the northern city of Djibo, documented by Human Rights Watch. The government said it would investigate the incident more than a year ago. Daouda Diallo of CISC acknowledges that soldiers have faced heavy losses in their battle against militants. And this kind of music can boost the morale of the troops, he says. But on the other hand, he adds, One must also consider human rights and the respect for social cohesion between the community and all Burkina Bay citizens. Claire McDougall for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
And that's it for this Wednesday, September 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Button in Washington saying, have a